how diverse is your workplace? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead, why building a more inclusive and diverse culture at your office is good for business. We will have some thoughts about that in just a moment. It's 549-2937. Then later, it's the great debate, whether to ban plastic straws. Where do you stand? Our new contributor, Mike Favo, will tell you what he's thinking. Plus, an old-fashioned good time this month at the Jacksonville Fair. All of that's coming up. But first this morning, the current toxic climate in America surrounding race and immigration issues is driving our polarized politics, leading into next year's 2020 election. Hate crimes are up and divisive workplace incidents are catching headlines everywhere. Just the other day in a suburb of Chicago, a group of African-American diners was asked to move to a different table because they were allegedly offending a white regular customer who sat nearby. So this is a big deal for the workplace. Corporate leaders know that having a diverse workforce that stresses inclusion and equity is good for the bottom line. Getting there sometimes is easier said than done. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at these issues and how they've been popping up here locally, too, as we welcome Tammy Hodo, PhD. She's CEO of All Things Diverse, LLC. Tammy, good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And what are your thoughts about building diversity and inclusion at your workplace? What are the issues you've seen where you work? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Now, Dr. Hodo, you recently spoke about these issues at the TEDx Jacksonville event where you deconstructed race. You also have provided training to the staff at MOSH, the Museum of Science and History, to prepare them for their upcoming Legacy of Lynching exhibit. So these issues resonate both all over the country and right here in Jacksonville, correct?
Very much so. Reality is that we are at a pivotal point in our society where we really need to make some decisions if we're going to continue to be productive citizens and work together, or if we're going to continue to be separated, which we're seeing a lot of separation right now based on race, ethnicity, immigration status, sexual orientation, and identity.
Right. On the one hand, people might see a much more diverse society and think we've made a lot of progress. On the other hand, we have the data shows we really do still have a long way to go.
Very much so. I'll give you some examples from academia, which is where I come from. When you look at even our local universities and you think about the representation of minorities in positions of power, it's lacking. We don't see a lot of minority faculty. And the red herring I always hear is that, well, we don't have enough minorities with doctorate degrees who are qualified. And statistically, I can tell you that is incorrect. That's just something, you know, that is always said that statistically, again, is incorrect. And oftentimes, while universities and other organizations work really hard to recruit diverse staff and faculty and executives, they don't work really hard to retain them. And at this level, if we're not being treated, you know, as the actual member, you know, and on board and included in the conversations and being heard, there's no desire for us to stay.
So that's the difference between having a diverse workplace and having an inclusive one, right?
Exactly.
What's an inclusive workplace look like?
That means that not only are diverse people at the table, but they're actually being listened to and that their input is actually being used to advance whatever productions or whatever, you know, whatever type of activities that they're trying to do, because being at the table is just not enough.
Yeah. And by the way, one expression I've heard said a lot is if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
And that's
but you're saying even being at the table isn't enough. What you say around the table needs to actually be listened to. That's a challenge for women, people of color, LGBTQ, anyone who hasn't been part of the typical power structure. So how do we change that?
Well, we need to begin to receive training. Reality is that America was set up on white supremacist system. You know, and everyone thinks that equity and equality are the same. That's not true. We have people who start at different vantage points. We know that white privilege is real. As a biracial person from the third most segregated metropolitan city in America, I can tell you growing up, I was cloaked in white privilege. I had benefits I didn't realize until I left my parents' household.
What city was that?
I am from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which just recently had a hate crime committed against a gentleman of Peruvian descent. He had battery acid thrown on his face by a 62-year-old Caucasian male for no reason. Well, he did tell him that he did that because he wanted him to leave his country and that they were invading, and xenophobia is very real in America.
Xenophobia is up. Hate crimes are up. You know, it's certainly a frightening time right now for people of color, for immigrants. And so you provide a lot of training and consulting.
Yes.
Mainly to employers who are seeking to foster a company culture where people don't feel threatened or uncomfortable. What are some of the biggest obstacles you've seen when you go into corporate America and you talk to them about this stuff?
I see a lot of fragility. I see that people are very concerned because the demographics are changing. And I believe that a lot of Caucasian people, which is the dominant group, feel that they don't have a say. But reality is everyone needs to be at the table and they need to be involved in these conversations. I've also seen a lot of situations where people are talking the good talk about diversity, but they're not actually implementing any policies. You know, so they're saying, OK, yeah, we did this training on microaggressions or implicit bias. And so we've checked that box. And that's all they're doing. But reality is unless you're ready for some type of litigation, which is happening more and more, you know, you need to do more than just that.
It's 549-2937 to join us. So what should a company do then? Once they check the box of having the training, then what do they need to do?
It needs to be a continuous conversation. So if we were to say in the school system, maybe a quarterly in-service training, as well as when I was at a law school, we would do a town hall and I would present usually monthly. And, you know, and diversity is more than just race and sexual orientation. We're talking socioeconomic status. You know, we have a lot of people who don't know the societal cues because they're first generation college students. You know, we're talking more, again, than just black and white, but people continuously think that that's all diversity encompasses.
Right. What would you say to those listening who I can feel some of them already out there rolling their eyes? And they might say, yeah, I went to the diversity training seminar at my office. I went to the sexual harassment training seminar at work. I don't do any of these bad things. Why do I need more training? And it doesn't work anyway. These are the kinds of pushbacks managers get sometimes from their workforce when they try to change company culture. What would you say to those folks?
I would say that, you know, continue to keep your mind open. Realize that you could actually then maybe be successful in being an ally, you know, or do some bystander training where when you see these situations, you're actually prepared to step up and assist and help someone. You know, call out when you see microaggressions, you know, gain the skills that you need to be an actual ally to these marginalized communities.
Now, you mentioned you grew up in Milwaukee, one of the most segregated cities in the country. You grew up on the white side of town, right?
I did indeed.
So you had one perspective as a teen, young adult, and then another one when you left that neighborhood?
I did. I grew up very much cloaked in my mother's white privilege. She's 5'8", blonde hair, blue-eyed. And she, of course, like any mother, is your biggest advocate and ally. So she always took care of things for us. I left her home and I went into the United States military, where I actually had my first experience with institutional as well as interpersonal racism. And I think that is
what happened.
Well, there was an incident and I was called the N-word.
And first time in your life?
No, actually not the first time in my life. The first time was I was 16 years old, walking to the bus stop in Milwaukee, leaving my job at McDonald's, actually on my side of town. And it was yelled out of the window at me to go back to my side of town because we're so segregated. And it was funny because I was actually on my side of town. But I had an incident in the Navy where I actually had a high-ranking person say the word 5 times and say that we people need to get over the word. And he didn't understand what the big deal was.
What'd you do?
I wrote my mother, and there was really nothing I could do about it. But I did have an E8, a senior chief, who was Caucasian, who spoke out and told this very high-ranking individual that if he continued to use the word, that he was going to report him to EO himself. Because I just was not in a position of power. I'm 18 years old. I'm enlisted. You know, I'm not aware of how this system works. And I was just, I think, really, my eyes just glossed over. I couldn't believe that that had happened.
Right. And so that's something when you hear stories like that, African-Americans, when they talk about the first time someone called them that, it's sort of seared into your memory, isn't it? You don't forget that.
I'll never forget. I was on North Avenue. I will never forget exactly where it happened, the color of the car. There were four white gentlemen in the car. One on the passenger side yelled out and told me to go back to my side of town.
Okay. And, you know, Milwaukee isn't unlike Jacksonville in that we are a segregated city still in many respects. And as we talk with Tammy Hodo, we want to ask you, what do you think diversity means in the workplace and inclusion? What's your workplace like? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. James is on the north side. Hey, James, good morning.
Yes, ma'am. Got a question for you.
Sure.
When you first on your intro, you said that there was an incident at a restaurant where apparently it's a white family was sitting there and a black family was there, and the black family was asked to leave due to, I guess he felt uncomfortable. Was this a racist incident? Or was it just somebody that was annoyed by maybe some behavior of the other people at that table? Because, you know, I'm finding the news today that the first thing that pops out, people think everything is racist. Was this a racist incident or just one person knowing what was going on at another table? Because, I mean, we all done sat at a table, and some people maybe next to you maybe, you know, acted up and carried out. And God knows you wish you were somewhere at the restaurant, so. I was just hoping you could elaborate on that.
Sure. Thanks, James. And I'm just reading from the Associated Press copy here. The attorney representing a group of black customers says they were asked to change tables at a Chicago suburban Buffalo Wild Wings because of their skin color. Apparently, a regular customer who was white told the management of the Wild Wings he did not want to sit near black people. And they asked the black table to move, and things escalated from there. Now they're suing Buffalo Wild Wings. So, Tammy, Dr. Hodo, this is an example of how being insensitive, particularly to your paying customers, can not be good for business, because now Buffalo Wild Wings is going to have to deal with a lot of fallout from this incident.
They are indeed, and they will definitely see it in their revenue. We saw, you know, something similar with Starbucks, and then they shut down for a half a day and they did implicit bias training. And we know that ultimately this type of behavior impacts your bottom line. You know, it impacts your turnover rate and employees. It impacts productivity. And then we're talking litigation, you know, so it does indeed. And I'm sure we'll see some boycotts.
So the employees at that Naperville Wild Wings, they didn't have the training they needed to handle that incident appropriately.
Not at all. And I can't believe that an actual server went and asked them to move. If anything, I would have asked the gentleman. I would have let my manager know and then asked the gentleman to leave.
Right. Now, you mentioned Starbucks. Starbucks, of course, went through a whirlwind of negative publicity and issues when a couple of customers, I think it was in Philadelphia.
It was.
They came in and they were waiting to meet someone. So they were sitting at a table waiting for their friends to show up. And they were asked to leave by the management, two African-American men. That's what prompted Starbucks woes.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And I'd be interested. I mean, I could always research to see how it impacted their bottom line in regards to revenue.
Right. But, you know, it's like you said, corporate leadership knows that they have to get this right. It's getting it right that's been so difficult for so many companies, actually following through
right.
with what you're recommending. Okay, let's go to Keith in Riverside. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. I attended Dr. Hodo's TED Talk, and I highly recommend it when it's available. I just want to say that, you know, having served in the military for 20 years and chosen to avoid the workforce after that, it is not just the workforce where you're experiencing these problems. I've personally witnessed a growing hostility towards people who look like me in my everyday life, and if you're willing to speak out about that, oftentimes the first thing people try to do is silence you, whether in the workforce or otherwise. And the organizations need to learn that the people that are speaking out are your best indicator of what's happening in your organization.
Keith, thanks for that. Dr. Hodo.
And Keith, thank you. I know Keith, he's a very nice gentleman. I think that oftentimes we do hear people say, you know, oh, well, you're pulling the race card or you're too sensitive. Believe me, most people, that's not the first thing that we go to. It has to be pretty blatant. And oftentimes, especially as a biracial person, I often think, well, oh, they lack home training, you know, when something happens, or they don't like women, because I experience intersectionality. Not only am I a woman, but I'm a woman of color. But sometimes, well, certainly now in the current climate, it's so blatant. You cannot deny it. We lived in the Virginia area, and I remember the Ku Klux Klan was recruiting, and we lived in a predominantly white area in a subdivision. And they had the audacity to actually put flyers in everyone's mailbox, you know. So I think it's much more people feel more emboldened now, and they're expressing themselves, and they feel entitled to do that. And I think that causes a lot of problems. I, for one, really got tired of hearing people say, well, we live in a post-racist society, when we had our first biracial, not black, biracial president of the United States. But what we see now from a sociological perspective is white lash, you know, and we're seeing that, and people were very fearful, you know, of this man being in charge. And now it seems that everything that he has done is being, you know, pushed back. And we see people trying to work really hard to undo anything that was done by the Obama administration.
Describe the term white lash. How do you define that?
Well, I define that as what we've seen with the rise of the alt-right, you know, and we've seen more white supremacists, right? They're no longer in hoods. They're in suits, you know, and so it's just a change in the look. But we've seen, you know, instances. Think of Charlottesville.
I wanted to ask you about that, because that made news again the other day. The neo-Nazi and white supremacist Richard Spencer, who led the Tiki Torch protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, that appalled millions of Americans. It was over controversy over removing a Confederate statue there, and it ended in the death of a woman named Heather Heyer because the riots and the protests there got violent. Okay, the other day, audio that was leaked from the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, before it disintegrated into violence, audio was recorded, and it features Richard Spencer screaming racist and anti-Semitic slurs that he generally avoided using in public. In public, he presented himself as well-spoken, wearing a suit, as you said. In private, he spoke in the most horrific of ways. Now, this touched our area, too, because there was much controversy over Spencer speaking at the University of Florida in Gainesville. UF allowed him to speak. They did not ban him from the campus. However, they did everything they could to marginalize his appearance, and it ended up being a bust. Hardly anyone came to it. And so how do we look at an example like Richard Spencer and his hateful rhetoric in our current political context?
Well, again, I just think people feel very emboldened. And as you know, as we just spoke about, people wearing suits and speaking the Queen's English and not, you know, using hateful rhetoric in public does not mean that they do not have an ulterior motive. We see people in positions of authority within legislation, U.S. government, who have some very racist, Islamophobic, homophobic ideologies, and they seem to appear at certain times. And then they're surprised when everyone finds out. I mean, people are not in robes anymore. They're in suits. They're using coded language, kind of watered down. We see the rise of white nationalists and just very much, I mean, the tiki issue in Charlottesville was unbelievable to me. And then when I say Black Lives Matter and people say, well, all lives matter. So if my house is on fire, but yours is not, you know, and I say my house is on fire, well, mine could be, you know, it's kind of like still just silencing the movement and people not understanding it is not anti-police. I mean, it's not that's not what it's about at all.
All right. Here are some tweets. Here's one from Sierra. Your guest just reminded that diversity and inclusion includes socioeconomic status. Some people who are first generation college students may not know societal cues. Never has a sentence described my life so succinctly. Learning to be professional is its own type of code switch. That's from Sierra. Here's one from Jim. Thanks for covering diversity in the workplace. It seems to have taken a back burner to efficiencies like Lean Six Sigma. thanks for that as well. Okay, and let's go to some calls. Pastor Troy on the East Side. Hi, Pastor Troy.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
That's great. Well, I certainly wish the doctor good luck in her journey there to bring about equality, but I'm afraid that a significant plurality of people in this country are dedicated to keeping it the way it is, particularly here in Jacksonville. Black people know they're third-class citizens here. They don't buck it. They just pass it along. Don't make waves. Go along to get along. Jalen Ramsey certainly found out. Even though he was the number one draft pick, they treated him just like a common slave, and he left. And look at the result of it. That's all. Thank you.
All right. Let's take his points one by one. We'll talk about Jalen Ramsey in a minute. But first, you've lived here now for what, 4 years?
4 years.
Do you agree or disagree with his comments about race relations in Jacksonville?
I would have to agree. I would have to agree with them. I have realized that I now live in South Georgia, not Florida. I have had people do and say things to me in the workplace that have been unbelievable. I didn't realize the level of ignorance in America, but I think that we really need to work on our school systems because we know that people, the history is not accurately depicted. People are not aware of the historical context, you know, and how this country was built on racism. Let's recognize that this month is Native American Indigenous Peoples Month. We're on Indigenous land. I mean, that was really almost a complete genocide when we look at the population that's left now and the racism that they experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard people talk about racism. Well, I'm white and I've experienced racism. And I think that we need to understand, or they'll say reverse racism. That's an emotional response. Reality is that, yes, the demographics are changing, but economically, politically, and socially, white males are still very much on the top of the hierarchy. And I don't think they have anything to be concerned about anytime soon.
Well, that said, what are your thoughts about last night's election results in a few states around the country? We saw particularly in the state of Virginia, where you said you used to live, a real sweep of Democrats. And that was something that got national attention because Virginia is seen as a bellwether for the nation in many respects.
And I'm very proud to say I did leave there. I was a faculty at Virginia Commonwealth University. And as I used to drive down Jefferson Davis Freeway on my way into work to teach about racial and ethnic minorities.
Former head of the Confederacy.
Right. Former head of the Confederacy and Monument Avenue with all those monuments to the Confederate, which I do have to mention. Most were not built until after slavery was outlawed and the failure of Reconstruction, which I think most Americans do not understand. I think that, you know, the change is good. I think that we see also in Kentucky, we saw a change to a Democrat. And I mean, not trying to be partisan, reality is that equity and equality are different. And equity is recognizing that sometimes other people we have to give them the tools to be successful. And a lot of communities are starting 400 years behind others.
Okay, so bringing it back to Jacksonville, you provided some of the training that you've been saying companies really need to invest in to the staff at MOSH to prepare them for their Legacy of Lynching exhibit. That's going to be a powerful exhibit. What did you do with the folks over at MOSH to get them ready to present this to the public?
So they actually have the exhibit now.
It's actually up now. Pardon me.
Yes. And they were phenomenal. So I worked with them during their staff retreat. And we talked about implicit bias, which we all have implicit biases. And we talked about having those courageous conversations and understanding the language that we use when we talk with people. We talked about microaggressions, which are those kind of daily, seemingly unconscious verbal assaults towards marginalized groups. So just providing them the tool set they needed to interact with the public as they came in and saw these powerful displays, you know, of lynching that happened, this terror of lynching that happened in America. There were actually 9 that we know of lynchings mm-hmm. in Duval County. I'm sure there were more, but we know of 9. And so from the Equal Justice Initiative, they were able to bring the stone here that has the names of those who were lynched. 2 were unknown. As per my understanding, they've recently found out who one of the unknown victims were, but just providing them insight into how to have those conversations.
And how to deal with what you call and what a social scientist call microaggressions.
Yes.
Give me an example of a microaggression.
So I remember being a panelist on somewhere, I won't say where, and we having a conversation. And afterwards, someone came to me and thanked me for my professionalism. And I thought, wow, I have a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Why would I not be professional? And that would be a microaggression. Or certain things like if you say to a person who identifies in the LGBTQI community, I would have never thought that you were gay. You know, it's like 1,000 cuts every day. And it's just tiring, you know, and Du Bois, who is a famous African-American sociologist, talked about this two-ness and code switching and how we are living in a society often that does not value us. But we have to play this part in order to be successful.
That's tiring.
I'm exhausted.
Are you?
I am.
What do you do about that?
Talk with my husband, write, you know, about it, talk with some allies. And I think that's important, is that people need to understand they can be an ally. You don't have to be part of the marginalized group, but you can be an ally to that group. You know, so get training, you know, ask for diversity officers to come in, such as myself, and provide your organization that training with bystander intervention. You know, learn how to interact with people who don't necessarily look like you. We see people who continuously self-segregate. We do that, you know, and that's part of the in-group, out-group. You know, we see it in the criminal justice system when we look at disparities in regards to sentencing.
There are so many ways that this affects us in our American society. So if you're a corporate leader, you should give Tammy a call, Dr. Tammy Hodo. PhD, she's CEO of All Things Diverse. She provides workplace training here in our area and consultancy to companies seeking to create a more diverse and inclusive corporate culture. And we thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, and up next, another hot topic. Where do you stand on the great debate? Banning single-use plastic straws. We have new polling data on this. And our new contributor, Mike Favo, too. He's made up his mind. Find out what his take is right after this.
Joy and pain, he opened up our minds.
Welcome back. Well, a new UNF poll out this week finds most voters in Jacksonville approve of the idea of levying a half-cent sales tax for repairing local school buildings. They also overwhelmingly support the full legalization of marijuana. And here's something else they were polled on: plastic straws. This is a more divisive issue. 42% of you out there support a ban on single-use plastic straws in restaurants and retail shops. But slightly more local voters, 47%, oppose such a ban. Still, many are learning to love their new metal straws. That includes our new contributor. First Coast resident and occasional commentator Mike Favo tells us, it's the kids who changed his mind. Take a listen.
The 1967 movie The Graduate has a poolside scene where family friend Mr. McGuire tells Benjamin Braddock that he has one word for him: plastics. He states there's a great future in plastics and pushes Benjamin to promise that he will think about it. This scene echoed in my mind recently as one state or city after another pursues bans on plastics of various forms, the most famous being California's plastic straws upon request law for restaurants. Ironically, The Graduate is set in Los Angeles, a city very serious about scaling back one-and-done plastic use. A year ago, I'm not sure I would have even noticed. I probably would have shrugged it off because, well, many of us tend to shrug off ideas that begin in California. But for me, this one has been a little different, and I've learned much about straws in 2019. Earlier this year, the calming effect of the car radio was interrupted by this. I asked my daughter where that strange sound was coming from. She explained that her new metal straws were in her backpack because she and my wife were having boba tea after school. She noticed a perplexed look on my face and gave me a quick tutorial about reusable straws reducing plastic in the landfill. The following Saturday at workout class, I noticed a friend taking her water break with a metal straw sticking out of the top of her high-tech insulated drinking cup. I was curious. Was I just noticing everyone else because of my daughter's reusable straws, or was this a fast-developing trend? I asked my friend, and she explained that it was a gift from her daughters. They have a Go Green Club at school that believes we can break the habit of using plastic straws that might end up in the ocean. The insights from these teenagers left me feeling utterly old and out of touch, so I headed to Google to get up to speed on the latest trends. I searched metal straws, and the screen blew up. I could be exaggerating a little, but 40 million results seemed like blowing up to me. I watched a TED Talk video made by 9-year-old Molly Steer in 2017. She gave a simple and pragmatic presentation that showed how easy it could be to use fewer straws, which makes a pretty big dent reducing plastic waste. Smart kid. Next, I was clickbaited to watch a mermaid talk about straws. She told me about collapsible, reusable drinking straws. She swims with Emma Rose Cohen. Ms. Cohen and a partner started a very successful company out of her desire to reduce plastic waste in the oceans. As I watched the collapsible, reusable straw in action, I wondered why no one came up with this idea sooner. Smart kid, smart mermaid, smart daughters. I'm starting to get it now.
Thanks, Mike. In a moment, the incredible success of our own new local podcast, Oddball. We'll be right back.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the legacy of Fred Rogers with the 17th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT, all Vistar Credit Union branches, Sedith Moving and Logistics, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, visit wjct.org/events. Contributions will be donated to area nonprofit organizations.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m., only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, we want to take a moment to do a little bragging right now. People all over the country are just loving WJCT's new podcast, Oddball, created by our own Lindsay Kilbride. It was recently recommended on NPR's podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. Let's hear what host Linda Holmes has to say.
What is making me happy this week is a new podcast that I discovered via NPR One. It is a podcast called Oddball. I found it a fascinating history podcast. It's fun. It's entertaining.
It is entertaining and fun. I want everyone to download it and listen. More than 250,000 users have discovered Oddball. It's been featured in Apple Podcasts New and Noteworthy, among other accolades. News director Jessica Palumbo is here now to crow a little bit about our Oddball success. Hey,
yes, Melissa, hearing Linda Holmes, first of all, Linda Holmes, I'm a big fan of Linda Holmes and have been for a long time. And hearing her on Pop Culture Happy Hour just casually dropping the name Oddball was so exciting this week, because that's not something that we paid for. That wasn't a special trade that we worked out with NPR. That was just good old fashioned somebody discovering Oddball and loving it. And so many people across the country have done that. And it's just so exciting. The fifth episode dropped on Monday, the fifth and final episode. So if you are one of those people who have been waiting to find out how this story ends, now is your chance.
You can go to oddballpodcast.com to listen to all of the episodes. And without giving too much away, let's explain what the story is all about.
It is a local story, and it's a weird story, but it's a true one. So I've talked to people about this, and they start listening about the family who found this weird metal ball that's about the size of a basketball in the woods here in Jacksonville back in the 70s. And people hear this and they go, oh, okay, so it's a fiction podcast. And you're like, no, this actually happened here in Jacksonville to a family. And what I really like about it, Melissa, I'm not really like a super sci-fi or weird mystery nerd person, but I love the personal aspect of this story. It's a personal journey for the family who found this ball. And it's also a personal journey for Lindsay. And we go on the journey of discovery with her. So we go through the entire reporting process. I'm not going to give away what she found, but I think that's really the satisfying thing as a listener, to go on that journey along with her.
Yeah. Lindsay does such an incredible job telling this story and keeping your attention, keeping you hanging to the next episode. And I think we're all so excited and proud about this, because, you know, I recall first talking to her about this years ago.
Right.
And she started working on it unofficially a couple of years ago.
That's right. On her own time.
On her own time. And every so often I'd kind of check in with her and say, how's it coming? And
yeah,
I'm so glad that it has been such a success. And we also want to give a shout out to Bold Bean, because if you pay for a bundle to hear the podcast and also get some Bold Bean merchandise, that's another option too.
Right. If you go to oddballpodcast.com and go to the shop, you can pay $10 to get a tote bag, $20 to get a tote bag filled with Oddball blended coffee, a special blend made specifically for the podcast, and an Oddball mug. Or you can pay $30 and get everything together. So we do have some options there for people who just want one of those things. Or if you just want to go and support WJCT, we've had many of you who just think that doing podcasts and projects like this are worth doing, and they let us know with just a little bit of extra support on top of their regular support for WJCT. That's really appreciated too. So just check everything out at oddballpodcast.com. Get your merch, get your coffee, and give us a little bit of support. And also just go to the Apple Podcast app and leave reviews and leave ratings there if you enjoy the podcast so other people can find it.
Yeah. And as we plan a new podcast, let's talk a little bit about the growth of podcasting. Because even though the majority of people still get their news and storytelling over the air radio, podcasting is growing. I think between 12 to 15% of our listeners out there regularly listen to podcasts, and that number is only expected to grow. So, you know, some of the people out there listening may love podcasts. Some listening may have don't even know what a podcast is,
right,
or have never checked one out. So let's talk a little bit about why podcasting, particularly when it's a really well done series like Oddball, is so compelling.
Well, we've done podcasting a little bit so far, right? First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is a podcast that you can listen on demand anytime. And that's sort of how we've started. But podcasts like Oddball that tell a story over several episodes are definitely something very ambitious for WJCT and very different and kind of a risk, honestly, for us, because it's a very time intensive, resource intensive project. Mm-hmm. And we're just so excited that it's been so well received with hundreds of thousands of downloads. Just for episodes 1 through 4, we've had more than 300,000 individual listens of these, and it's only going to grow from here. So it's just been more well-received than we could even imagine. We're very excited. And I will say that these do have re-listenability too. As the editor of the podcast, I did have to listen to them several times, and I just enjoyed them more and more the more I listened to them. And it, as you said, she really keeps our attention to the end.
And that's hard. It is hard to do that. So kudos to Lindsay Kilbride, to you, Jessica, and everyone that helped market and promote Oddball here in our building, and to Bold Bean Coffee, thank you as well. And again, this is really exciting because there's such a crowded marketplace out there for podcasts. It's hard to get one that stands out and really gains traction across the country. It is so hard to do that, people. So this is a huge achievement. Go to oddballpodcast.com and take a listen to the mysterious story of the Betz Sphere. First seen on Ancient Aliens.
That's right. Melissa can tell you about it in the podcast.
Take a listen to it in a moment. How you can have fun at the fair this weekend. That's in just a moment. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
On the next Fresh Air, Saeed Jones talks about his new memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives, about growing up black, gay, and closeted in Texas in the era when he thought gay meant AIDS meant death. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan describes the memoir as raw and eloquent. I hope you'll join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
We We talk about the shortage of affordable housing all the time, but did you know there are also millions of houses and lots that are just empty?
Seeing abandoned, blighted, fire-damaged properties citywide started to kind of play on my psyche.
I'm Molly Wood, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
The breathalyzer has put untold numbers of drunk drivers behind bars. They're designed to measure if someone is fit to drive, but a New York Times investigation is raising serious concerns about their reliability. How do we give law enforcement the right tools to keep our roads safe? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the Greater Jacksonville Agricultural Fair kicks off tomorrow. Come on out for rides, concerts, treats, and some new surprises. Gail Hart is VP of Sales and Marketing at the fair. She's here now. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I've seen the Ferris wheel go up. I've seen all the other stuff go up at the fairgrounds. It's that time of year again.
It's that time of year. The cattle came last night. So when the livestock starts moving in, you really know it's fair time.
That's when you know. Okay, so the fair in America has such a long, incredible tradition. People look forward to all the traditional things at any county fair, but you have some new things this year, right?
We do. One thing about our fair, with the price of an admission ticket, we have free shows. And one of the new shows is the Stingray Encounter. That is educational but fun. You'll be able to touch a stingrays. And there's an educational leader that will, you know, point out the dangers and the fun things about stingrays. So that's a new thing. We also have Jump the Dog Show. And then, which is
like
exactly—
like the Westminster Dog Show? Yeah,
well,
like trotting dogs?
And, no. Mm-hmm. This is like trick dogs.
Okay.
Where, you know, they do all kinds of tricks and you know, children just love them. The other one is Agri Puppets, which is teaching agriculture in a really fun way.
Because that's really, at its heart, what a fair is about, is promoting American agriculture.
And actually, it's so important right now because younger people need to know and understand our food sources. You know, that if we don't have that, if we're not growing food, if we're not maintaining, you know, the landscape or working in, you know, in the fields, at the farm.
Yeah.
And there's new ways for that, you know, with hydroponics and new ways to learn to have sustenance.
So people will learn about some new techniques.
Yes.
Yes. That's exciting. You know, when my mom was a little girl, my mom grew up on a farm and she was in 4-H. And so many more children were closer to agriculture in that era than they are today. So this is a small way that you can introduce your kids to.
Yes.
Livestock, how food gets grown, and then have some fun, too. There's a lot of fun attractions.
Yes. Well, one thing that we do have, we have an entire exhibit about the crops grown in Florida. So that's one, you know, that's one way for our children to, like, understand, you know, what happens here in Florida with citrus, with potatoes, just, mm-hmm. you know, leafy vegetables. We have a program called AgVenture that is open to third graders. And in that program, it is teaching about agriculture, you know, about what's grown in the ground, about, you know, animal husbandry. And then we also teach them how to make butter, how to make a rope.
So they get to do all that at
the fair. They get to do that. Well, it's during the day. It's programs that for third graders. And we make those reservations, you know, in September. So it's
now. I also noticed, Gail, on your news release, you put out the lineup of all the live bands that will be performing, mm-hmm. including the Cowbell People themselves.
Yes,
Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah,
I'm going to go to that concert, and I'm going to yell more cowbell as many times as I possibly can.
Yes, we had them last year, and. It was packed, and we couldn't believe it because it had been raining previously. So we kept thinking, God, we have to find another band. like Blue Oyster Cult. And people kept asking for them, so we brought them back.
Do they play cowbell when they play Don't Fear the Reaper? Do they come out with the cowbell? Or not?
Not exactly like Will Ferrell does it. But
see, that's what I'm hoping for.
I know. And it's such a fun, but that band is so fun. We also, tomorrow night, we are having what's called a guitar pool. And I've never done it before, but Chris Jansen is going to headline that along with Stephanie Quayle, Mitchell Tenpenny,
okay,
and Seaforth.
So with all of that said, the fun kicks off tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
People come on down to the Greater Jacksonville Agricultural Fair, parking right across the street in that garage.
Get online at jacksonvillefair.com so that you can see. It changes each day, the lots that are going to be $5. But we do have $5 lots that the city has granted us that.
Okay, so there will be a place to park. Come on out. You can buy your tickets at the door, right,
yes,
Gail?
Yes, or today.
Or you
They're
can
online.
Even get them online today.
It's advance tickets in tonight at midnight.
Okay, so again, that website is
JacksonvilleFair.com.
JacksonvilleFair.com. It's time to come on down to the fair downtown at the Jacksonville Fairgrounds. The fair runs for 10 days.
11.
11 days.
Until the 17th.
I'm getting everything wrong here. But I will get this right. JacksonvilleFair.com and Gail Hart. She is the fair's vice president of sales and marketing. We'll be stopping by. It's right across the street from us. So we'll look forward to it. I'll see you there, Gail.
Oh, can't wait.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for listening. I'm Melissa Ross and this is First Coast Connect. If you're catching our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for music. And tomorrow, we'll have new polling out this week from UNF on where you, the voters, stand on selling JEA. That's tomorrow. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.